Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 176 on how to invest in land in 2021 with no money down. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to invite high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers onto the show and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Today's guest has been here before. Longtime listeners will remember Mark Podolsky, a.k.a. The Land Geek. Mark focuses on high-volume, low-cost land flipping with a focus on using those deals to generate long-term passive cash flow, putting himself in a better situation with taxes. As you're probably already aware, the U.S. land market has been heating up over the past few years, with COVID only serving to supercharge the market as people flock to places where they can have more distance from other people. Mark and I discuss this trend, as well as a few recent deals, including a development expected to generate more than $1 million profit. Let's begin. All right, welcome back to the REI Diamond Show, Mark. How have you been?
Dan Breslin, pulse is normal, respiration's fine. So glad to talk with you again. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, for sure. I love having high quality guests come back on the show a second time because it kind of gives us this different timestamp perspective, you know, for the curious podcast listener. I will include the 2018 recording that Mark and I did in the show notes, but you can kind of go back to then and then come to now. And I just think it's so revealing to kind of pay attention to trends in real estate. The more that you are comfortable with the trends, the better your long-term investing strategy is, and probably the way you run your business and, you know, maybe even life in general when you're paying attention and on top of the trends. And these revisiting episodes, Mark, that we're getting ready to dive into today, it really provides that, you know, perspective of how things evolve and change over time. And I know on the last one, we probably did something similar, but I would like to begin again today with the Land Geek's creation story. So what your business looks like today and how did you get here, Mark?
Sure. So, you know, the way I got here, you know, we rewind the tape. It's been 20 years now, Dan. I was a miserable, you know, micromanaged 45-minute commute to work and back investment banker, specializing in mergers and acquisitions with private equity groups. And, you know, I hated it so much that I wouldn't get the Sunday blues anticipating Monday coming around. I'd get the Friday blues anticipating the weekend going by really fast and having to be back at work on Monday. So my firm hires this guy. He's telling me that it's a side hustle. He's buying up raw land, pennies on the dollar, and he's flipping them online, and he's making a 300% return on his investment. And I'm looking at companies all day long, and a great company has 15% EBITDA margins or free cash flow. Your average company is at 10%. And I'm looking at companies all day long, less than 10%. So, of course, I don't believe them. And I've got $3,000 saved up for car repairs. I go to New Mexico with him. I do exactly what he says to do. I buy 10 half-acre parcels, an average price of $300 each. I flip them online, and they all sell for an average price of $1,200 each. It worked. So I went to another auction where I live in Arizona, and again, this is 2000. There's no one in the room, and I'm buying up lots and acres for like nothing. And I sold all that property over the next 6 months, and I made over $90,000 cash. So I go to my wife, and she's pregnant at the time. I said, honey, I'm going to quit my job, become a full-time land investor. And she's like, absolutely not. So I said, okay, fine. So it took me about, in total 18 months for the land investing income to exceed the investment banking income. And then I quit. And I've been doing it full time ever since. I've done over 6,000 transactions to date. And I absolutely love it.
Nice. And you also kind of for Business Today and over the last couple of years, I think you kind of started getting a little heavier into some software programs. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah. So, you know, the philosophy being like, we can always make more money. Like, solving money problems isn't that hard, but solving money and time problems, that is sort of like the holy grail. And that's kind of like, you know, why we're doing all this is to create this passive income. So, you know, to do 6,000 transactions or to do that kind of volume, it's really a business. And so anything that we can do to automate, I want to do it. And so I want to use three leverage points in my business, which is other people's time, other people's money, and software. And the software is that we've developed now has evolved so much since last time we spoke. It's unbelievable. I mean, literally saving thousands of hours.
All right, cool. Why don't we start a little bit of the land conversation here? It's 2020 now. It's been 2 or 3 years or so. How do you find undeveloped lots, undeveloped land for sale? Or maybe a better question, Mark, how do you find off-market land, which you can actually buy for a good price?
Right. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to these counties where we know there's really inexpensive land. So there's 3,007, you know, U.S. counties. So where do you go first? I mean, let's just face it, Dan, like nobody wakes up and thinks themselves, boy, I'd like some raw land today in Iowa, unless you live in Iowa. So we're going to focus on, you know, California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Oregon, Washington, Florida, these fast growing states, the sunshine states. And then we're going to go about an hour to 3 hours outside of a major city. And we're going to get a list from that county. And what we're going to do is we're going to price that list. So again, you know, I don't want to be in the appraisal business. I don't want to send out a blind offer saying I'm interested in buying your land. Cause the next thing you know, now I'm in a negotiation. Like, oh, I'm interested in selling my land. We're going back and forth. It's not an efficient use of time. So essentially what we want to do is price the list. So all I'm going to do is take the comparable sales for the last 12 to 18 months of that raw land. I'm going to take the lowest comparable sale and divide by 4. And that's going to get me a 300% margin of safety. And then from there, I'm just going to take that list. I'm going to load it into my software, and it's going to automatically send out offers at 65 cents a letter with address verification automatically, first class mail. It's amazing. And so that's really how we want to get that deal flow rolling, is by sending out actual offers. And Dan, we're looking for a 3-5% response rate. So if it's under 3%, I know I priced probably a little too low for the current market. But if it's over 5%, I probably need to renegotiate and retrade because I probably got in too high. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. The savings in time. Are these DocuSign, or are these like they will sign off on a physical 2-page, 3-page agreement of sale that you're sending off? Like, how does that work? And now they reply to that and engage by just accepting the offer, I imagine.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So they can either mail back the offer. So it's not through DocuSign. They can do like a QR code and go to like a little landing page and accept the offer. So we make it as easy for them as possible, depending on how technically literate they are. They could even call or fax to accept the offer.
Okay, so let's play it out a little bit further down. They accept the offer. What's the next step? How long are we under contract with them? When are they expecting me to show up with a bundle of cash for their land, or however I promise to pay for that? And like, what are your next steps as far as maybe selling or doing some due diligence about whether the land's worth anything or not?
Yeah, exactly. So our intake manager will take it from there, and they will contact the seller and say, hey, we got your accepted offer. This is the next step. We're going to close in, you know, as fast as possible, about 7 days. Now the actual offer letter, we give ourselves, you know, about 30 days before we close it, but we want to, you know, sort of, under promise and over deliver. Say, look, we're going to do our due diligence. I'm going to get back to you. 7 days are left and we're going to close this transaction. So during that time, then the intake manager will pass that off to our due diligence team, which is if it's $5,000 or less, we're going to outsource it to our team in the Philippines. They're connected to an American title company and they're going to fill out everything we need to know. We want to make sure there's no breaks in the chain of title, no liens or encumbrances. They still own the property, that the back taxes aren't too high, that it's going to, you know, destroy the margin on our deal. We want to know what's compelling about the property. We want to get plat maps, GIS maps, aerial maps. We want photos around there, video if we can get it, and give this thought a whole property checklist. So then once everything checks out in due diligence, the intake manager, again, will contact that seller and say, hey, look, we're going to go ahead and send you a deed. You're going to print it, sign it, notarize it, and send it back to us. And that's if it's $5,000 or less, we'll just close directly. Now, if it's $5,000 or more, we're going to close to a title company. Now, once we own that property, this is where the magic happens, because we're going to sell that property 30 days or less and make it cash flow. But I don't want to go too far in, Dan, without hearing your voice.
Yeah, I appreciate the break there.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So 5,000 or less, it's kind of like we're still checking the title to make sure things are clean, but we're not having to pay the, I don't know what it would be, $400, $500 or so extra to get the title insurance added on there. I'm curious, have you ever gotten in trouble by not having, you know, you sell it for, let's say, $15,000, $20,000, whatever you end up getting for it, and then a title issue did come back to bite you on one of these $5,000 deeds?
Yeah, no, I've never had an issue. I mean, it's not like housing where, you know, we're talking like real money, $100,000 or more, or even $50,000 or more, you know, super small house or whatever it is. You know, these are small deals. They don't change hands a lot. It's rural land. I mean, you know, the biggest thing you got to really worry about on the due diligence piece that can't be cured, like even an IRS lien can be cured in 90 days. The biggest thing is going to be, is there an environmental issue? And again, we're not going to places like Pennsylvania or New Jersey where, you know, there's a lot of manufacturing, or maybe even Ohio, and a chemical company could have spilled out there. And now you've got a Superfund site. Now, the what you would do essentially is to make sure you're not in a Superfund site, and our team does this just on all the properties, just to make sure, is you go to epa.gov. And you make sure that you're not buying in a Superfund site, because then you're talking about millions of dollars of cleanup that you could be liable for.
So you might buy it for $5,000 and you sign a deed and you literally could be on the hook and they could come after you personally for an unfathomable amount of money, right?
Right.
Not good.
Yeah. No, not good. So that's why you got to make sure, you know, you're not buying in those areas. Now, again, I've been doing this 20 years. I've never had that issue, but we still check it.
Makes sense. All right. So let's frame the land, the piece of land itself. I mean, this is a 3-hour drive from whatever it is, the bigger city there. I imagine there's not a whole lot out there. Like, what's the size of the lot? What is the purpose that this potential buyer we're getting ready to touch on? Like, what are they going to do with the land, Mark? Why is this valuable?
So, you know, basically, there's a lust for land in this country that most of us don't realize. I'd say that the majority of our buyers are what I call legacy investors. So they just want to own property. And the fact that they can afford it, because, you know, if they're looking around their own city, it might be unaffordable for them. But we make it like a car payment. So we make it irresistible for them. And they might go out there, they might camp or hunt or fish, but it's the only asset that lasts. It's this generational investment. And they sort of heard growing up, you know, own land. And so I've never been stuck with a piece of raw land. It's kind of crazy. They all sell. There's a pig for every barn.
So, see, it sounds strange to me. So we did 247 houses so far this year, and like I am stuck with one or two of them actually, only because I'm not really willing to come down on my price much more. And there's this pain of reducing the price, and I know I'm losing money with every not losing profit. We're losing real money we already have in on these houses, you know, by lowering the price. And so I am kind of stuck with them, but I'm not because we'll eventually sell them. One of my, you know, operating philosophies, if you will, Mark, is do a huge high volume of deals, because if there are some losers, and a lot of times there will be a loser here or there, at least in my experience, and make some mistakes by doing a high volume of deals. But the high volume of deals, like a stock portfolio, there's more winners than there are losers. And, you know, it all averages out at the end of the day, you know. So it sounds very strange to me, Mark, when you say, yeah, there's a buyer for this place. I'm in Illinois. I'm in Chicago. I live right here on the lake in the middle of Chicago in the city. It, you know, 3 hours south into the bottom of Illinois where it's like farmland or something like that. Like, man, who's going to do anything with it? Like, I don't even know anyone who would want it. The campground stuff and hunting and fishing, I guess that does make sense when you say that. But how do you find these buyers?
So we're going to market first to the neighbors, right? So we're going to send out a neighbor letter, and we're going to say to them, hey, here's your opportunity. Protect your views. Protect your privacy. Know your neighbor. So oftentimes the neighbors will end up buying it. I mean, this is like this built-in best buyer and sort of this advantage that we have. Now, if the neighbors pass, we'll go to our buyers list. So these are people that have already indicated an interest by either saying they're interested in raw land or buying raw land from us in the past. And oftentimes they'll buy. Now, if the buyers list passes, then we'll start marketing on, you know, Craigslist. It's the 10th most trafficked website in the United States. We'll go to Facebook, buy, sell groups and marketplace, and then we'll go to the lands. Landmodo.com, landandfarm.com, landflip.com, landhub.com, landsofamerica.com, these land platforms where people buy and sell raw land every single day.
Interesting. Is there a process for building a land buyers list? I mean, do you have one for South Dakota and one for Colorado and one for, you know, this state? Or is it going to be the same flock of buyers that somehow has this land list, no matter what remote location it actually exists?
I think it's sort of they're location agnostic for the most part. They just want to own raw land. So even if they're located in New York City, if it's, you know, if it's in Nevada or Arizona, they don't care. Like, the desert's the desert to them. And they just want to go to a cool place that is outside the city. So we're marketing to them. We're not really doing a whole lot of segmentation. Once in a while, I'll get, like, when we email our buyers list, I'll get an email back saying, hey, do you have anything in Texas? Right. And in that case, we're like, okay. Yeah, we do. And we'll just send them a listing. So, you know, we're not letting our buyers sort of dictate where we're buying. Like, we want to buy the property 25, 30 cents a dollar. We're making our money on the buy. We know we'll sell it.
It just boggles my mind that there's land hoarders in this country like this, enough to build an entire business. It's pretty cool. So can you talk about the deal structure a little bit? I mean, you mentioned selling to them on car payments, but paying $5,000, you know, how does that math work on a $5,000 deal, Mark?
Sure. So let's just take a deal that I just did in West Texas. We sold it for $20,000. I believe it was $249 down, $249 a month. And 0% interest, and we paid $4,000 for it. So our annual yield on that deal was over 60%.
Gotcha. Are they land contracts? Or are you doing like a deed of trust? I mean, does it kind of unwind quickly?
No cost of foreclosure. We only do land contracts.
Okay.
Only land contracts. So let's say that. So we use a program, a software program called GeekPay.io, and it's a set it and forget it system. So we'll get the down payment via credit card, and then we'll get their checking account information routing number, account number one time, and then the system will draw the will draw from their checking account each month. Now, Dan, let's say that they don't have any money in their checking account for that month, and it bounces. We can use the credit card as a backup as well. So it really lowers our default rate on those types of things. But if they don't have a, if their credit card balances and their checking account balances, well, then they've got 30 days to cure the default. And if they don't, we keep the down payment, we keep all the monthly payments, and we just resell the property. So it just increases our ROI on that situation.
Gotcha. So is there any risk when you're owning this land in the land contract that you would have to keep property insurance on the land? I don't know. If someone crashes a dirt bike on there and you got a land contract, who would be liable for something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in reality, it hasn't happened to me yet, knock on wood. But the way that we protect ourselves and the way I recommend people to do that is if they're homeowners, they just need an umbrella policy on top of their homeowner's insurance. But typically, that's the reason that we have an LLC, so limited liability. They can just sue the company. But again, it's, you know, you have this umbrella policy, but to ensure, because when we're doing the volume that we're doing, to ensure every single piece of land would take too long and be too costly for like a commercial policy.
Gotcha. Yeah, so as long as that, what do they call them, the black swan event doesn't occur, it's okay?
Yeah, yeah, and so far it hasn't. I had somebody, I remember years ago, they're out in Nevada, and they got a, they're out like, you know, 30 minutes from town. It's rural Nevada. They're looking at their land, and they're telling this harrowing story that they went off-road, and the car got a flat tire. They barely had any water. They thought they were going to die out there, and the whole time I'm waiting for them to, like, you know, I want a refund. They're like, we loved it. We want the adjoining lot.
That was great.
This great adventure, this great story. They almost died, but they loved the land.
Put a spare tire, make sure you have the jack in the car next time, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So what type of inventory is involved in the business? So I know you do this where you, you know, teach people the business, Mark, and you kind of have like the students running their business, I believe, separately. What type of inventory, like, do you have right now for sale, just to kind of give an idea of like the numbers and volume it takes to be successful at doing what you're doing?
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, I'm probably a little bit of an outlier because I've been doing it so long and we've got this machine built. So at any one time, you know, I'm going to have 100 to 200 properties in inventory. We try to do a deal a day is going to be our type of volume. But I would say that our students, you know, for them to get to, you know, let's say $10,000 a month in passive income, in 12 months, they're going to need to do, about 8 deals a month to get to that number. So it's not a tremendous amount of volume, but, you know, that should do it. To get to, you know, about 5,000 a month in passive, you need to do about 22 deals at, you know, what average about $200 a month.
Okay. And what kind of a monetary and time commitment do you think would attach to each one of those two numbers, Mark?
Well, we tell our clients, you know, they need to budget an hour or two a day of focused time in the business. And again, the whole idea is, you know, to make it a business. So a business, you know, is going to outlive you and me. They should be able to travel around the world, and this passive income machine should continue churning it out. But to build, to start building that infrastructure, hiring the virtual assistants, getting the teams in place, the software, it takes some time. So, you know, maybe about a year learning curve, let's say. Then that second year, it really sort of, it goes up from there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. That's actually doesn't sound too crazy. I mean, I spend a lot more of my business, obviously, but I imagine that, you know, 1 to 2 hours. I mean, you know, we we say 1 to 2 hours, and it probably sounds like not a lot. But in reality, for a lot of people to have 1 to 2 solid hours of doing something they have not been doing forever, it's kind of hard work. You're kind of having to really push and use force of will because it's not something you're used to doing, right? It's not, you know, you're setting up these VA relationships and stuff like, dude, it's kind of can be a challenge if you haven't done that stuff already. I mean, it is no small thing, but it is a small time commitment, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a simple model, but it ain't easy. If it were easy, everybody would be doing it.
And what about, cash marketing wise? So you had to use, I forget what the first deal, 3,000 deals, and you bought, 10 lots, and then you sold them off. And so, like, what kind of a cash reserve would you have, and what kind of a monthly budget would you also have to have in order to, you know, get to the $5,000 to $10,000 per month coming in?
Well, you know, it depends on how you structure it, right? So if you're doing cash deals and you're flipping at 300%, well, you can start with, you know, $1,000 or less, and it'll move the needle because you just build up your cash reserves real quick through cash sales. And then, but when you start doing terms, you'll run out of money at some point because your capital recovery, it might be, you know, 6 to 12 months before you get your capital out. So at that point, we tell people, look, you're making 300% to 1,000% ROI. If your yield is, you know, 70%, it really is irrelevant at what you borrow at. Get as much money as you can get at 2%, 3%, 5%. Nobody, you know, there's so many friends and family that are making 0% of their money. Do them a favor, you know, do a debt deal with them, pay them back quarterly 10%. They'll be super happy. You'll be happy. And that's how you scale your business to the next level.
Yeah, and as you talk about it, the barrier to entry to me, so I'm, again, single family real estate, small multifamily stuff, 2, 3, 4 flats, right? That's our specialty, mm-hmm. Mark. The barrier to entry is, it's kind of high. You know, you're talking 50, 60, 80,000 by the time you buy a house and renovate it on the very, very low end, whether we're talking Atlanta, Philadelphia, or Chicago, where I operate my business. I mean, it's hard to find a $30,000-$40,000 house and then put 50-60 in it, especially with some of the risks that come with some of those neighborhoods that are $30,000-$40,000. So the real barrier to entry for a lot of investors in these three markets for us, in single family and residential, and I imagine throughout the United States as well, is probably more like $150,000 to $200,000. So I recently funded a deal through one of my private lenders, and we pay 10% and 2 points to our money network. You know, people go to fundrehabdeals.com, they sign up, we send out our private mortgage investment opportunities. But for someone to participate there and fund one of our deals, Mark, they have to be an accredited investor, number one. And number two, they actually have to have the $200,000 that we need it. And it's got to be in a position where it does not have to be liquefied and returned to them until we're actually done the deal, which could be 3 months, 6 months. We might hit some snags and it's all of a sudden 9, 10, 11, 12 months. They're earning interest the entire time, but the illiquid and larger amounts of cash kind of keeps a lot of people from being able to play the game. But as you're talking about your thing, you know, if this was like my brother that came to me, you know, or my dad was going to do this business, or, you know, vice versa. Like, I know that my dad would have been in a much better position years ago if I was starting this business to hand me $10,000, which could be leveraged into, I don't know, 1, 2 deals, it sounds like. Maybe I get lucky and I get 3 deals, you know, if I'm getting into the land business, versus my dad was in no position to hand me $200,000, you know, 15 years ago when I started in the business. And so, barrier to entry wise, it feels like, and I'm out on a limb because I don't know your business, but it feels like you can do this with a much smaller pool of seed capital in the beginning and really kind of get momentum and velocity and build it up. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So, yeah, I mean, you're 100% correct. I mean, it's, you know, we've got people that have started with like $800. I started with $3,000. It's very, very low, you know, very, very low capital cost to get started.
Nice. So, I mean, since 2018, when we first did our episode there, How has the land market in the United States changed since that time, Mark? Has pricing started to get a little higher? Has the market gotten more competitive? Or have things stayed relatively flat and it's been the same operating business? And, you know, if it's not 2018, maybe we go back to 2010 and you kind of give a price comparison of what the trend or the trajectory might look like going forward.
Yeah, so it's been a very weird 2 years, where 2019 was really good equilibrium. It was easy to buy and it was easy to sell. 2020 with COVID, we cannot keep anything in inventory. This was like, we went back to 2006. So when, you know, the government does a stimulus and there's all these dollars going into the economy, well, where do people go then for inflation hedges? They go to gold, silver, and land. And it was just insane this year as far as, you know, selling land. So we, as fast as we bought it, we would sell it. As a result, prices have gone up this year. But the ratio has gone up as well. So our, you know, I'd say it's been a little harder to buy, but really, really easy to sell. I think as we go into 2021, I don't know how it's going to be. I mean, we're due for a recession. I'd like to think that there'd be some kind of dip, but I don't know. It's, the market is really hot.
Yeah, it's kind of what I expected, right? So are prices increasing? Are you seeing more people actually paying cash, or is it the same? You know, you're selling them the same way on terms, and the balance of cash deals versus terms deals is kind of equal through 18, 19, 20, or have you started to see like maybe a weighting toward cash buyers suddenly in the market? Now they're out competing, you know, the terms buyers are getting squeezed a little bit.
Right, right. No, I mean, terms are always easy because, you know, you make it a car payment. I'd say that, you know, we probably do 90% terms deals, 10% cash deals. The only reason we ever do a cash deal is just because they insist on it or they just pay off their note early. We really don't want the cash. We want the cash flow.
And is some of that wanting the cash flow having to do with kind of your overall tax strategy, or is it just the higher price and the person paying cash wants a better deal? What's that all about?
The person paying cash, they don't want the debt. They just want to own the property. They want the deed. Sometimes it might be cultural. If you have somebody from, let's say, China, they just want to pay cash for everything. They just don't believe in debt at all, for the most part.
Gotcha. All right. What questions have I neglected to ask that you feel like the listeners would love to know the answer to?
I don't know. I think, you know, if I were a listener, I'd want to know, you know, why is it so great? Why is Mark teaching this and telling everybody about it? That I'd want to know if I were a listener.
And me too.
What do you think, Dan? Yeah. So I think the answer to that is that the market is massive. And I remember my wife and I having this conversation. She's like, well, you know, this is years ago. Like, you're going to teach people how to do what you're doing. You're going to create your own competition. And so I just put on my investment banker hat. I said, okay, well, you might be right. Let's just see how big the market is. And so when you analyze the billions of acres in this country and how few people are doing this business, because if you go to, let's say, a RIA meeting, and there's 100 people in that room, Dan, you and I would be the only land guys. 99 of them are going to be house flippers, wholesalers, or landlords. Because if you go on HGTV or the DIY network, you'll never see a show called Flip This Land. The before picture is raw land. The after picture is raw land. It's the most boring niche there is. So all we're doing is shuffling paper and making money. And ever since I've been doing this, you know, my investment company has only grown. Our clients' businesses have grown. There really is no competition when you look at the size of the market. And there's no big money in it. There's no private equity groups, no hedge funds.
Are most of the deals in this price point that we kind of, you know, played out for all of our examples, or are there examples that you have that are not necessarily outliers, but where, you know, the deals are made in $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 pieces of land, or is that maybe what's reserved for the private equity and the big money is the larger priced parcels of land?
Yeah, I mean, larger price. So again, that's going to be too small for them too. You know, let's just pick on some of the bigger landowners. They're billionaires. So Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett. So what they're buying productive farmland or timberland, and they're making 8% on their money. And they're very happy with that 8%. It's just a very steady sort of bond, if you will. And then they'll get some appreciation with it. So that's really, if you're a billionaire, you're Ted Turner, you're buying, you know, cattle ranches and that type of property. You're not even playing in our little niche, because at some point then it's just, you know, it's just too much volume. If you're a private equity group, you can't even manage it. It's just too much money in one place.
Yeah, it makes sense. So are you guys playing mostly, it's all $20,000 deals all the way across, or are there any pricier deals than that come through this niche?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, if I can deploy, you know, a couple hundred grand on a deal and subdivide it, that's a nice big deal. But again, we're not talking real money here. So we're doing a development deal. We're buying, you know, a 115 acres of 1,000 an acre. But after we subdivide it, we're going to flip it for 5,000 an acre on easy terms. We'll have all our money out 3 years. But we're going to make, you know, $1 million on just that one deal.
Nice. Where is that type of property located? Is that going to be 1 acre lots that are buildable, or are these going to be 1 acre campsites like some of the other ones we talked about earlier?
Yeah, those will be buildable lots. We're going to put roads and infrastructure in as well. So those will be a little bit more of like a development type deal. But again, you know, there's no restrictions. If someone wants to camp out there, they can. But the end buyer is most likely going to want to eventually, you know, do something with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do those lots have water, or are they going to be well? Or are you guys putting in pipes?
No, that would be by well.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Nice. Congratulations. Sounds like a good deal.
Yeah. I mean, that's all we do, Dan, are good deals, just like you. You know, we don't do bad deals.
Ah, I've done a couple bad ones. I've done a couple record-breaking bad ones. It's the nature of the beast for me, I think. We do enough deals, but hopefully more good ones than bad ones. We do a whole lot of good deals, but yeah, some of them. We talk about our winners usually, I'm sure, in public. Well, I've had some losers too, so we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. I did a deal, I mean, it was a bad deal. We screwed up on the due diligence and had POA fees. We were buying these things for like 50 bucks a lot, but we missed on the due diligence. They owed like $3,000 a lot in POA fees. So,
oh wow.
And so we're like, wait, this is terrible. This is the first deal I'm going to lose money on. So I'm like, you know what? Screw it. Don't pay the property taxes. And then what we'll do is we'll let it go to auction and we'll just apply for the overage. And so we did that. We didn't pay the taxes. It, you know, because once it goes to tax sale, it wipes out that lien, the POA lien.
Mm.
And we made like $8,000 on the deal, on the overage.
Wow.
It was pretty great. So even when we make a mistake, there's a way to salvage it.
Yeah, it sounds like you're lucky there on that one. The wiping of the liens could potentially the POA, what does that stand for?
That's a property owners association.
Gotcha. Okay. So the POA, could they have, in theory, went and applied for the overage and then got it in front of you as the owner, but they just neglected to do that in that case?
I guess in theory. But I don't, you know, they don't want to own the land. They just want their fees.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. And they didn't
get them.
I don't
even know if they know about it. It's kind of, you know, the overage situation is not that well known.
No, that's
because, you know, it's not
cool.
Like the county is going to, you know, the county wants to keep the money. They don't want to tell anybody.
Yeah, you're right about that. So cool, Mark. What books have you recommended lately? Are there two books, real estate or otherwise, that you find yourself recommending most often?
Let's see. The two most recommended books, I would say, you know, The Combination of the One Thing by Gary Keller and The 12-Week Year by Brian Moran. I think those two books combined are just magical. I always recommend those two books. You know, and then of course, a shameless plug. My own book is Dirt Rich. I think it's pretty good, Dan. And then I'm working on a sequel to that. I don't know if I'm going to call it Dirtier and Richer, How to Scale Your Land Business. That one I'm working on. And if you've ever written a book, it's miserable. I don't recommend it.
I have only one.
Yeah. I must hate myself. But I'm trying again.
That's cool. Yeah, it can be fun to think through all the thoughts and put it all together. So, Mark, you know, I ask all my listeners this, and I know that we probably asked you that in 2018, and we'll probably go back and figure out if the answer was exactly the same. But this is the REI Diamond Show. It's all about the jewels of wisdom. That said,
Right. Let's
talk about the crown jewel of wisdom, Mark. Is there one thing you'd share with your younger self, or maybe one thing you wish you knew then that you know now?
Yeah, I wonder if I said this 2 years ago. I wish I knew how to meditate when I was younger and just experience, you know, everything arising and not getting identified with good and bad thoughts. That would be like a superpower if I could have done that when I was younger, for sure.
Nice. How long have you been, I assume, doing this on a regular, maybe daily basis?
Yeah, I do it on a daily basis. Gosh, years now. Years. I don't know. 5, 6 years. And I love it. I mean, I now it's like the best part of my day is just this hour I just spend with myself. Literally doing nothing except, you know, watching my mind play out some dramas and then, you know, getting back to the moment and just you kind of just realize, holy cow, there's really nothing out there that's going to make you happy. It's all internal. It's just a weird experience when you experience it, but it takes a while to get enough mindfulness to get there.
Yeah, it makes sense. I am an avid fan of Bulletproof Radio, which is Dave Asprey. This guy's going to live to 180 years, and he puts a podcast out, has a brand of supplements, used to be on the anti-aging something in Silicon Valley, right? But anyway, on his show, he had a guest, and he has a lot of guests who are doctors and this and that, and it's all about anti-aging. But the doctor would take patients who are experiencing things like anger issues, Mark, things like depression long term, people who have issues sleeping, anxiety attacks, panic attacks, and they would use this kind of alternative treatment plan where they would put them in the MRI machine, I believe, and they would like kind of check out the, and it may be a different type of brain scan they actually use, but they look at the brain and they would find kind of these dead spots. And what their conclusion eventually came to be is, a lot of times people have these brain traumas from childhood. You fell off a bike, you fell out of a tree, you played hockey, you played football, you got hit with the baseball, you got in a car accident, you tripped and fell. And they found that, you know, the brain literally needed these different protocols to kind of redevelop connections to be able to use these neural networks fully and completely. And a couple of the small little things this doctor said that he would have almost all patients do were fish oil pills like twice a day and kind of adjustments to the diet, maybe adding more fish in there, maybe avoiding gluten in the breads and, yeah, obviously the sugars. But the one thing, and this is why I bring up this long-winded tangent, the one thing that they also included was a 20-minute meditation in the morning and a 20-minute meditation at nighttime. And I started doing that at least a year, maybe a year and a half ago, and I do it with the Muse meditation device, which gives you kind of feedback on your app to see if you're kind of quote-unquote doing it right, because you have your actual, like, kind of, it's not scientific feedback, but it is some sort of like way to get feedback to see what is going on in your mind. And man, it has been one wonderful year and a half. The same thing you're talking about, this level of happiness, well-being, the calmness, my sleep is better. So that was a long-winded, you know, plug and bow to kind of the meditation thing. It's been as equally life-changing for me as it sounds like it's been for you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Do you do the Bulletproof coffee?
I was doing Bulletproof coffee every day, and I think I kind of screwed up by doing it every day. So now it's like maybe once a week or less. It was kind of giving me like this indigestion by doing it every day. How about you?
You know, I love coffee, and I've been drinking coffee for like 15 years, you know, daily. And I became like a coffee snob, and, you know, I would spend like an hour in the morning drinking coffee and doing this whole ritual. And then I was like, you know, what would life be like without coffee? So I think it's been like a month now, and I have to tell you, like, I'm sleeping like a teenager now compared to when I was drinking coffee. And, you know, I was just, you know, substituting that time now to meditate. And, because I used to just meditate for 20 minutes. So now I meditate for an hour, and, it's great. It's great. I'm not really missing it. At least not yet. So
it probably kind of won't.
But I did the Bulletproof coffee thing too. What's that?
I said, you probably won't at this point.
No, I don't think I will. It's just, you know, it's kind of, you know, socially, like, you know, you're that person now. Oh, you don't drink coffee?
Fair enough. Well, cool. Hey, how can listeners get some more information about you or the Land Geek, or maybe even the softwares that we were talking about earlier?
Yeah. I mean, the best place to start is thelandgeek.com. I don't think we had this 2 years ago, but I created a wholetailing course, how to double your money in 30 days or less. And it's normally $97, but I'd love to offer to your listeners for free if they just go to landgeek.com/quickdeals, and they can get that course and see if this is, you know, niche that resonates with them.
All right, cool. Well, hey, I appreciate you taking the time out. I got a couple pages of notes. Great conversation. Great follow-up here. It's interesting to see the U.S. land market in these tertiary areas developing and heating up here per your feedback there. And I appreciate it, Mark. Thank you for coming on the show.
Dan, thank you so much for having me again. I really appreciate it.
My favorite way to fund a fix and flip deal is by using private money. I did an episode on raising private money for single family flips a little while back, detailing my entire process with Joe Fairless, as a matter of fact, which you can find at reidiamonds.com by typing raising private money into the search bar. But what if you don't have access to private lenders and need money to get started? Everyone usually talks about hard money, and that's great as long as you have some reserves or a nice chunk of cash in the bank to show the hard money lender in order to get the loan. They like to loan money to people who already have a little bit of money, at least, to be able to cover the payments and any other ancillary construction items that may come up. But one little known and little talked about option is gap funding. And gap funding is a line of credit used to access the funds needed for reserves, business startup costs. I mean, there's really no restriction on how you use the funds. And it's called gap funding because it's used to fill in the gap. The team over at REI Pathway Funding can set you up with gap funding line of credit, which has an initial interest rate of 0%. And in certain cases, if you qualify, it does not show up on your credit report as it's structured as business loans. So to find out how much you might be pre-approved for, go to www.reipathwayfunding.com. And thanks again for tuning in. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can also, to access the 175-176 episode archive, you can go to reidiamonds.com. So my main business, Dan Breslin, my main business, Diamond Equity Investments, is that of buying, renovating, and selling houses. We bought and sold 223 houses in 2019, and we've been blessed to grow, I think about 40 to 50% year over year. And we've done 273 houses so far in 2020. And as I'm recording this, there's a few more days in the year to add a few more closings. We currently have another 108 houses in our inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold and awaiting closing. So here's how I can do business, you and I can do business together. First, if you are interested in having access to the best real estate deals in your market, go to www.accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, are you an accredited investor who enjoys double-digit returns? If you'd like to potentially invest passively in a real estate deal or several of mine, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails. And number three, I am always buying houses that I can flip, and I buy occupied apartment buildings with below market rents. If you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, fellow Forbes Real Estate Council member and Smart Real Estate Coach founder Chris Prefontaine joins us to discuss no money down real estate deals with average profits per deal of $75,000 and up. More on those fat deals next time. Danny B, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.